So we are going to be getting into this study of the early church. And the first statement might not be something that you've heard too often, which is on the day of Pentecost, the Christian church begins in Jerusalem. But it is ultimately true. On the day of Pentecost, that's where the church begins formally. Then we walk through last session talking about a little bit of the context of the Gospels, what was going on in the places around Palestine, around Judea, some of the personalities involved, but really that day of Pentecost that unfolds in the early part of Acts is where we see the church beginning. Now, I'm always particular about this, perhaps just because I'm particular about some things. I really don't like talking about the early church because it makes it sound like it was a monolithic institution, like there's only one church that was out there, or one form, and we're going to talk a little bit about this. There are actually a diversity of forms that emerge rather quickly. Ways that they did church, different apostles taking different methods into these different towns and villages and cities as they went out with the gospel. And what happens, it emerges rather quickly within the first generation of the followers of Christ that there are a lot of different forms. Not as diverse as we are today, to be fair, but even in the more monolithic tradition, sort of like Roman Catholicism, there's a great diversity that goes on in there. There's actually a movie coming out about the two popes. And they got the guy, I forget his name, who looks exactly like Pope Francis to play Pope Francis. But then they also got, and he just went out of my, Anthony Hopkins is playing Pope Benedict the 16th, and it's talking about that transition point that occurred, about 3-4 years ago. Actually, it's probably a little bit more than that at this point. Actually, probably about 6-7 years ago, where Pope Benedict the 16th stepped away from the papacy and allowed Francis to come into power. Benedict is it's a really interesting movie that's going to be coming out because it's kind of talking about how Francis has brought a new non-traditional, reform-minded approach to the Vatican, whereas Benedict the 16th, Joseph Ratzinger was his name, was a very staunch traditionalist. And it's kind of talking about the clash of those two things. If you get a chance, from what I've seen, it looks like it's going to be a fairly good movie. So it'd be worth checking out. What we see here is we recognize that even in the Catholic Church, just like happened in the earliest churches, and that's what I really prefer to say is the earliest churches or the earliest Christian communities. Because when we think about the word church, we have a tendency to think about a place like 16106 Middlebrook Drive in Houston, Texas, University Baptist Church. We have a significant building and we have a significant campus. We have a lot that's going on this campus any given time. We have a host of things that go on throughout the week, not just on Sundays, but really Sunday through Saturday. We are constantly going and we're constantly having a lot here. And we think of our church, we think of churches, at least I did when I grew up, as that place that you go to. It's on a campus. It's on a place. It's at a location. The reality is that for the first 300 years or so, there were no church buildings that are formal Christian gathering places like we would have today, but rather that for that time, Christianity met in various different ways in different places. So when we talk about the early church, we always want to add a little bit of carefulness with that, I think, because again, it's not a monolithic institution. It's not a singular vision for the church. The New Testament does a great job at a lot of things, and it tells us the story, and it tells us ways to live, and it tells us how the gospel works itself out. One of the things that the New Testament seems reticent to do is give us one form of how we should do church. And that's a really interesting thing. It actually kind of describes the way that church just kind of occurs. And I hear a lot of people in church work, and there's a couple authors that I'm thinking of particularly that talk about how, you know, we got to get back to looking how the early church worked. And we need to get back to getting our forms and our functions of what we're doing today and make it look like the early church. And they really begin, you start talking to them, and they really start reading Acts 2, 3, and chapters 2, 3, and 4. And they don't seem to read Acts all the way into chapters 22 or 23. They don't really seem to read all the other stuff in between because what we see in the early parts of Acts has a very different form by the end. And if you add in all the other letters in the rest of the New Testament, it has a very diverse form by the end of that, which some folks, a lot of folks think is the book of Revelation. But we see that there's a transition that happens there. So that's me being a little bit particular and giving you some explanation on that. But it is important to note that there's not this one version of church that comes out of the New Testament, but rather that we already see within the first generation of the apostles, within the first 16 to 20 years, that there is a diversity of forms. And we'll talk about that on the back page. We'll talk briefly about a couple different forms of communities that we see that come out of that. But nevertheless, on the day of Pentecost, the Christian church begins in Jerusalem. And there's some really interesting content about that. If you want to look real quick at the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 1, you're going to be able to find, or actually Acts chapter 1, and then you'll see a couple other places that we're going to touch on real quick that we see in the first part of this. This is Luke's continued narrative from his gospel. Again, I wrote the first narrative, this is verse 1, Theophilus, about all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day he was taken up, and after he had given instructions through the Holy Spirit to the apostles he had chosen. And after he had suffered, he also presented himself alive to them by many convincing proofs, appearing to them over a period of 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God becomes a very significant concept in the book of Luke and the books of Luke and Acts. And really, it's interesting. I have a copy of the scriptures of the Bible on my shelf that comes from the International Bible Fellowship and Institute for Biblical Studies, actually. And they put together, I thought it was really interesting, they removed the verse numbers and they created a text based off the NIV that's more narrative in form, and they put it in appropriate chronological order. So the Gospels are, their stories are combined in the appropriate chronological order. And one of the things that they did with it, they'll give you the chapter numbers at the top of the page. They just removed all the verse and the chapter numbers to try to make the narrative flow make a little bit more sense. And what becomes really intriguing about that is that they put Luke and Acts together. The other Gospels are kind of out on their own. The Luke and Acts are together, though. They're one continued narrative because that's the way that we suspect Luke put them together to begin with. And we see there that he begins by talking, kind of picking up what happens at the end of his gospel and talking about that. And he goes in and he talks, again, verse 9 through 11, about the ascension of Christ and what was going on. And after Jesus tells them that you will be, that Jesus kind of gives them additional commission there in verse 8 of being my witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. And then we also see that they went back and they were united in prayer. They went to the room upstairs, verse 13, and they were continually united in prayer, including the women, including Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers. And in those days, this is verse 15, Peter stood up among the brothers and sisters. The number of people who were together was about 120. Now, that's there for a really specific reason. 120 is not an accidental number of Scripture. What becomes intriguing about this is that when you get this occasionally, well, why is there 120 people? Why does Luke point that out? Well, in the Mishnah, which is a book of rules and laws for Second Temple Jews that was around this time, you had to have 120 people to constitute a new synagogue. So if you went out to constitute a new synagogue, you had to have 120 people in order to start it. What does that tell us about the first followers of Jesus? Well, one, they weren't Christians yet. They were followers of the way, is what we'll see in a couple instances. But we also see this, that they began under Jewish patterns of how they were going to form and constitute their first assembly. So there in Jerusalem, in the upper room, in those places where they're going to gather, they had 120 people. Now, when we think about 120 people gathering in a space, we think about a space maybe about this size. We could fit 120 people in. The reality is the upper room was probably a third of the size of this room, maybe a third to about half the size, somewhere in there, so three-fifths, and the size of this room, because they didn't share the same desire to have space in between them, and space and so forth. So there was, you can crunch a little bit more people in to the spaces that they were in. But we would suspect that the room would be a little bit much smaller than this room would have been. And yet in that space, they still had enough people to constitute what they believed was a synagogue. Now, why would they constitute the first church in some of the patterns of a synagogue? Because they thought they had the Messiah. And they said, well, we're primarily Jewish people. Jesus is the Messiah. Our natural pattern is to create a synagogue so we can tell people there's a Messiah here. And that's why they became followers of the way. And this is kind of the way that it kind of works out for a little bit. And we notice this. The book of Acts records the earliest activities of the early churches, while the letters of the rest of the New Testament provide additional information about these churches. And it's one of those really beautiful things that you get to see a little bit of the, when you get into the text, a little bit more depth that goes on in there. Particularly, like, one of the things I tell people all the time is you really need to read the beginning and the end of Paul's letters to get a sense of what's going on in the churches. Like, at the end of the book of Romans, in Romans chapter 16, he goes through this whole list of things that are going on among the churches in Rome. And he's mentioning people left and right and adding things here and there. There's just a ton of information. We have a tendency to gloss it over and because it's just not easy stuff for Bible study necessarily. But it's important stuff about the nature and the context of the churches. Another very significant passage about the nature of the early churches is the first, the second and third chapters of the book of Revelation, where we come into the seven churches of Asia Minor. We learn a lot about those churches by what John is writing there in the book of Revelation. During this time, power in the region of Palestine saw shifts in personalities, though it was rooted in Roman control. The Romans are still in charge, and they've taken great strides to continue to move their empire forward. This doesn't mean that Rome is a calm and steady place. It actually, as we'll see, becomes a very unsteady place for a period of time, as happens in many empires and kingdoms throughout the world. The grandson of Herod the First, Herod Agrippa the First, was appointed by Claudius in 41 and ruled the region until 44, when Agrippa the Second was appointed and had his territory expanded. And ultimately, what we see is that this comes from the book of Acts. If you go into Acts chapter 25, all the way there at the end, you'll see that. And you're getting into the later stages of Acts, Acts 25, 23 through 26, 32. You'll see, so the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the auditorium with military commanders and prominent men of the city. When Festus gave the command, Paul was brought in. And when Festus said, King Agrippa, and all the men present with us, you see this man, the whole Jewish community has appealed to me concerning him, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he shouldn't live anymore. And I found that he had not done anything deserving of death, but when he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him. So this is another example of Paul gets into trouble, and he leverages something unique about Paul, which is that he was a Roman citizen as well as being a former Jewish leader, as well he's ethnically a Jew as well. This is an intriguing thing. But what's curious about this is that King Agrippa, which is Herod Agrippa the First, is perhaps the person that is in charge at this point, and someone who Paul would have encountered. And what comes on is that Paul has a defense before Agrippa. And he talks about his own conversion, and he basically presents the gospel. And that ultimately what ends up happening is that that Agrippa says to Festus, which is there in verse 32 of chapter 26, this man could have been released if he had not appealed to Caesar. So Paul kind of got into trouble, and what does Paul end up having to do? Well, they decided that it was time for Paul, because he's going to appeal to Caesar, to go see Caesar. So he gets on a boat, and this is his journey towards Rome that we're going to end up seeing. And soon Rome shifted to the procurators over the prefects to rule the Palestinian region. And we see that here. I've got actually a list. Let me get into this real quick. These are the Roman, I think you can see, this is, I think it's big enough, maybe. These are the Roman emperors of the time period. I think you guys can see that. We'll see. It's tiny print. Tiberius ruled from, this is really in that period of time of Jesus' ministry. That's where I wanted to start. Tiberius is an emperor. He rules from 14 to 37. Gaius Caligula, and that's whose bust you see right there, rules from 37 to 41. Claudius rules from 41 to 54. Nero rules from 54 to 68, and there is a bust of Nero that was contemporary to his time. And you can go to one of the Roman museums and find these things. But then also Vespasian rules from 69 to 79. There's actually a little gap between Nero and Vespasian that we're going to talk about here in a couple minutes. Just because I think it's a fascinating time to talk about. But then Roman governors, in particular what we're talking about is the governors of the Judean region or the Palestine region. Pontius Pilate is in there. He was a prefect. That's what we believe, the person we believe to be Pontius Pilate or Pontius Pilate. Marcellus ruled from 36 to 37 as a prefect. Marullus was a prefect from 37 to 41. Agrippa the First, that's Herod Agrippa the First, whom we just read about in the book of Acts, becomes the king of Judea and rules in Judea from 41 to 44. This is some coinage that we found that seems to bear his image. One of the things that you would do when you took over an area or became a king, you would issue new money. They didn't have paper money back then. Rather, they had coins. And you would go and you'd issue new money. It was a big thing, and occasionally we find these in different places. It's interesting, some of the greatest archaeological digs that are happening right now is when they find old trash dumps, and they start digging through the old trash dumps. That's where they're finding some of the amazing stuff that they've been finding. But also Cuspius Fadius, Tiberius Julius Alexander, and this is when they switched to the procurators, Tiberius Julius Alexander, Ventidius, Commanus, Marcus Antonius Felix is in there as well, and Porcius Festus is in there, as well as Lysias Albinius and Jesseus Florus, who gets in there. And then really the last procurator, which is worth mentioning, is Marcus Antonius Julianus, which takes us up to right around 70. Now, the difference, which was what we're getting into here, between a prefect and a procurator was simple fact that prefects had a bit more oversight. They had civic oversight, but they could also command the military. They had regional control as well as economic controls. And the prefects, and prefects still exist around the world today, but in this time, they were given a bit more authority. Once you move in and you have a regional king like Herod Agrippa I, you end up with these procurators who are ultimately regional sub-chairs, and they have more of an economic interest or a financial oversight, and they could not, in general, command military units. The prefects would come from a very orderly succession of leaders. The procurators would come from people that were really just trying to find higher office. One example of this for today, in today's time, in the state of Georgia, they have been looking to appoint a new Senate, a new member of the Senate, because one of the senators stepped away due to illness. So this is the National Senate going to the congressional body. And what's been happening is the current president had recommended somebody to the governor, and the governor said, no, I don't want that person. I want to bring this woman in to make her a temporary senator for about a year or so before they could have an election. And she's worth a couple $1 billion. So we're going to put her in the Senate for a little while. And that's the way that it's kind of going out there. That's an example of how this kind of thing could happen. Somebody knows somebody that wants to move into higher office and they want to give them a good title, see how they work in a region that's fairly under control. And if things get out of hand, they'll just bring the legion in and they'll take care of stuff. That's kind of what they were doing at the time. And that's it's a worthwhile thing to point out. This is the distribution of the Roman legions right around the time of Christ and right around the time where Christ is. And you'll see there's a tremendous number of legions that are out there. And the Roman legion, not one that you wanted to run into, period, just because of where they are. There's a number of significant ones. You'll notice there's a higher concentration up in Germania or up in Gaul. And there's some more that are right around in here as well. A lot of this is because this is kind of the Eastern Front where they were trying to keep under control, because you had barbarians that were constantly trying to come down into the Roman region. Now, barbarians, we think of barbarians, you think of the, if you've ever watched, what's that, Gladiator, or one of those Roman movies, they're supposed to be these like grisly Germanic people that don't speak very well and are kind of Neanderthals. Well, the reason they called them barbarians wasn't because they were subhumans or they weren't well educated. It's because they didn't know Latin very well. And just like occasionally you'll hear me say this, I've already said it a number of times tonight, like an or an or one of those space fillers, I just did it, one of those space fillers when you're trying to think about something. In Latin, if you didn't know Latin very well and you spoke another language, the placeholder word or utterance would be bar. It was often bar, bar, bar. So they said, well, you're just a bunch of barbarians, because all you can say is bar, 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 bar. You're not educated. You're one of those people from afar away. That's why they were barbarians. It's not because they were Neanderthals or they were subhuman or anything like that. It's because they lived in really cold places and they didn't know Latin very well. We live in a really hot place and we don't know Latin at all. So we can work with that. But that you'll notice where most of their legions are. I'm kind of circling, because I know it's kind of a little bit hard to see some of this because of the nature of the, it looks really good in the atlas. And you'll notice that a lot of the legions are really the kind of the way that you would even set it up today if you're trying to go invade a land or you're trying to defend something. It's really on those frontier regions. And there are four legions right here that would have had oversight into all of the area of Palestine or Judea, Phoenicia, Galatia, and Sicilia, that would have had the ability to move quickly into that region. And they'll come into play very soon. But you'll see this is the extent of the Roman Empire in the time of Christ. Now, by the end of the first century, this is what the Roman Empire looks like. This is really the largest expanse for the Roman Empire. It became almost unmanageable at this point. If you go and you read The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is like a 4-volume set, I think you can get them for free on Kindle now. You can find it for free somewhere. They'll talk about how Rome fell for a lot of reasons. It's never one thing. It's a number of things. But one of the things was the empire was too big. You can't manage an empire this size in this day and that day and age. This is actually pretty easy to manage today, but we also have the internet. So there's a lot of extension that you'll see all the way out to sort of the western parts of Africa and Morocco, all the way over to Egypt. I mean, this is really where this whole area is. You have Hadrian's Wall, which if you're ever in England and you want to go see something really great, go up to Hadrian's Wall. You can walk the whole thing. They'll show you where it is. It's pretty amazing, something that old that's still out there. But this is really the expanse of the Roman Empire. In this time here, this is the kingdom under the kingdom of Agrippa II. The green space in all of this is what he initially gets. I think you can see there's a big giant Christmas tree in the way, isn't there? I think you guys can see all that. But down in here, this is kind of what he inherits all throughout here, up into the Galilean region. And this is kind of how he expands throughout here. He expands his empire. So Agrippa does pretty well in a time where expansion isn't the name of the game. Really maintaining your territory and taxing your people and making sure there's no revolts are the three keys to winning. Because if there's a revolt, they have a tendency to take your head off. So if you survive your oversight or your governorship of a region, that's a pretty good thing. Because these are tough times for despots. But nevertheless, so from Pentecost, Christian converts took the gospel message to homelands, and soon the first apostles dispersed throughout the known world. Now, what becomes curious about Acts is really a play in two parts. The first part is the very formative period of this church, and the primary character there is a guy named Peter. And you will hear about the apostles, but really by about the 6th, 7th chapter, the apostles just kind of disappear. And we don't really ever hear about him again, not very often. Now, we hear about him in the epistolary literature or the letters of the New Testament. We don't know what actually goes on. There's a pretty significant Christian tradition that talks about where they all dispersed to. Thomas would go all the way to India and take the gospel. And for you guys, it'd be all the way to India and take the gospel all the way to the east, to India, and as far as he could get there. And there's still a rich tradition of Christianity in places today, as far as India, where Thomas or a Thomas-like church would have been founded, and they still pay homage to him in Afghanistan or in Pakistan. Those remnants of where Christians still live, insofar as Muslims have not kind of brought sort of a more dominant religion there. But then also during this time, Jewish leaders continued to have significant concerns about this new messianic group worshiping in the temple and synagogues. They were very interested in this because, again, they put their leader to death. I was there. I watched the guy die, and all these people were running around saying, no, he rose back from the dead, and he's empowered us to go and to take the gospel into all these places, be converted, be changed by the power of Jesus Christ. And the way that the earliest Christians would do this is they would go into the temple, the ones in Jerusalem, and they would go because they said, hey, we're the next thing for Judaism. We are the fulfillment of Judaism's promise. And they would go in, and they had all kinds of challenges with that. But then when they were dispersing, they would always go, and this was Paul's missionary method. One, he would go into the local synagogue. It was one of the first places he would go because he spoke the language. And he knew the books probably better than the local Pharisaical leadership, or even if there were rabbis at that time, the local leadership. But then the second thing he would do is he would go into the agora, or the marketplace there in the town. And that was Paul's kind of his missionary method, because there was still in those day and ages, we didn't parse out all of our markets to HEB over here or Randall's or one of those other places, but rather there was a concentration in the midst of the city. It was an easier place to bring all of your stuff to with that. But that during this time, the Jewish leaders continued to have significant concerns about this messianic group because the messianic group was preaching a gospel that they didn't understand, and they thought they had put their leader to death. And there's some really interesting conversations that go on about this in the book of Acts. You can see some of this again through the lens of Acts and looking back behind it. In Acts chapter 5, there's a really stark example of this, that when they heard this is verse 33, they wanted to kill them. What is that? Well, that's the apostles preaching the gospel. But a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law who was respected by all the people, stood up in the Sanhedrin and ordered the men to be taken outside for a little while. And he said to them, "Men of Israel, be careful about what you're about to do to these men. Some time ago, Thutis rose up claiming to be someone, and a group of about 400 men rallied to him, and he was killed, and all of his followers dispersed and came to nothing. And after this man, Judas the Galilean arose up the days of the census and attracted a following." So he's going through kind of, hey, be careful about this, be careful about this. And he ultimately says that what Gamaliel comes to is that we must be careful about what we do with these people. And because we want to be careful about what happens. What's intriguing about Gamaliel is Gamaliel was a significant teacher of the law under whom Paul studied. And that Gamaliel would have been a significant theologian like we have even today in his day and age, and he would have gone out. But we also see that the pattern of worship emerges a little bit differently because it can't happen on Saturday anymore because it's a little too obvious. Because you can't go to the temple on Saturday or the synagogues on Saturday because that's when they all go to the synagogue or temple. So what's the next best thing? Well, Christians seem to have converted. Well, not converted. We shouldn't say that. They shifted to going to church on Sunday. And why Sunday? Because it was the resurrection day. Yeah, it was the day that Christ rose again. There's a couple books, I got a couple in my office here about the earliest Christian mass or the earliest Christian worship, the way that they did this. And there is a shift that occurs there. You'll notice in Revelation 1:10, "I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day," is what John says. Notice this, he says, which by the way, that little phrase there, "in the Spirit," this one right here, we've talked about this when we went through Revelation. I believe, is the key to unlocking the narrative portions of Revelation, because this enumity is how John structures out a lot of his visions and a lot of the things that he sees, because being in the Spirit, being in this ecstatic state, is kind of the doorway to the revelation that Christ gives him that comprises the book of Revelation. Nevertheless, the second most important, but the one that's really germane to what we're talking about, is this: on the Lord's Day. This is a unique phrase that we find in other Christian literature. That means that on a Sunday morning, John woke up and the Holy Spirit came to him and began revealing things that would happen. Just like we hope happens on Sundays in our worship services, that the Holy Spirit is able to reveal things to people, is able to speak to people's hearts, and we see life change happen. In that same way, on a random Sunday morning, John woke up and all of a sudden found himself in the Spirit, receiving revelation from God. Now, our hope is not necessarily a new revelation, but a different movement of the Spirit, perhaps. But the reality is that we see that there's a shift of worship. What happens in the book of Acts, which is actually right here, and you can see this in chapter 5, and then you go all the way back to, or you move down to Revelation chapter 1, and you see a transition. They go from meeting in the synagogues or the temples on Saturday to meeting on Sunday. There is a debate among scholars about a so-called Council of Yamnia or Yavnia, that happens supposedly in and around 70. And this is a Jewish council. And it's believed that at this council, it's kind of was a more popular theory in the mid-20th century, and they've kind of disbanded this a bit, that at least in some form or fashion, that Jewish leaders got together and they began, one, they initiated a program of removing any followers of the way or Christians from all synagogues and from the temple, which by that point in 70, the temple didn't matter that much. But they removed them from all the synagogues. But then they also began a campaign of oppression or persecution against those. And through that council, which whether that council happened or not, it seems to maybe have been a number of different ways that they decided that. They also came to a formalization of what we consider to be the Old Testament or their First Testament, the way that some people describe it as well. But anyways, one central figure in the rise of the earliest Christian communities was Paul. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on Paul because we've talked about him in the past and we seem to know him pretty well. Known earlier in life as Saul, he was a Pharisee and Roman citizen. He studied under significant Jewish leaders like Gamaliel. He was dispatched to arrest followers of the way. Again, this is where we see that term, followers of the way. And I'll read that real quick from Acts chapter 9. Now Saul was still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. And he went to the high priest and requested letters from him to the synagogues in Damascus so if he found any men or women who belonged to the way. And you'll see that in there, the way, he might bring them as prisoners to Jerusalem. And this is that's how the first followers were characterized. It wasn't until much later that they were called Christians, and they were called Christians in somewhat of a mocking tone. But they kind of adopted it because they were like, yeah, we're kind of like little Jesuses all over the place because it fits. And that's how we're known as Christians today. But for the first followers of Jesus in that first generation, they wouldn't have identified as Christian. They would have identified as followers of the way. Because what did Jesus say about himself? He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And there's some beautiful things about this. It can't be, you know, this is how they understood themselves. But then also on right there after that, on the road to Damascus, Saul experienced a vision and was converted. Saul, then Paul, became a significant leader in the earliest churches. He had three missionary journeys and a final journey to Rome. And these are important. The first journey happens in Acts 13, 14 through 28. And this is kind of the pattern of Paul's first missionary journey. Kind of originates out of Antioch. And it goes up through that kind of that southern region, southern south central region of Asia Minor. This is the first missionary journey. Then Paul's second missionary journey is found in Acts 15:36. And that, again, this kind of sources itself out of Jerusalem. And it follows this pattern up through here, through Damascus, through Antioch, all the way up and into up into Macedonia, which is right into here, down into Athens, into Corinth, and then kind of up to the churches of Ephesus, Asia Minor, down in here, and then back down to Jerusalem. If you were with us a year and a half ago when we went to Greece, we followed part of the second missionary journey of Paul, beginning in the town of Philippi and then Thessalonica, which is called Thessaloniki today, and then wandering kind of all the way down into Athens and to Corinth. And Paul never visited the island of Santorini, but that didn't stop us. So for a wonderful day there. But so that's his second missionary journey. As far as we know, he never visited the white sand beaches of Santorini, which at that point, no, it wouldn't have had the, it would have looked much like it looks today geographically, because the caldera had already collapsed due to the volcanic eruption a couple thousand years prior. The third journey, which is Acts 18, 23 through 26, is in there as well. This is the third missionary journey of Paul. Usually in your Bible, you can turn to the book of maps in the back, and you'll find at least two or three of these laid out, if not all three, in one singular map. And this, again, starts up in the kind of the town that Paul knew best, which is Antioch, and it goes up and back and around into all these places, and then ends up back down here in Jerusalem. And this is where we find that part that we had just read about Paul finding Herod Agrippa and going before him. And then finally, the fourth missionary journey of Paul, which was really not a missionary journey, it's kind of Paul's journey to Rome, follows this pathway, which goes, takes him from a port city. And again, for us today, we would sit there and say, well, why didn't you just go straight into Rome like this? Well, it wouldn't have been a very good idea, would it? Because they didn't like traveling on open water because they weren't running around in a cruise ship. They were running around in little boats that were wooden and were subject to the winds because they didn't really have a lot of good options back then. With that, we know that Paul wrecks. These arrows right here are the Etesian winds. Paul wrecks on the island of Malta. That we know that there's some challenges that go on with that. You can read about that again in the book of Acts. There's a really great sermon that a lot of guys have about the four anchors that are thrown out of the boat and the four anchors of the Christian faith. I know that because I preached one of them once. And it's a really neat way to talk about what is going on historically. But ultimately, this is the person of Paul. And then we know that Paul was likely martyred. And this is the last point for Paul. Paul was likely martyred in the late 60s under Nero's reign. Some folks will tell you that Paul was put up on a stake and lit on fire and was one of one of Nero's human torches. It's probably really not what happened. Because he was a Roman citizen, he would have been deserving a bit more suitable punishment. He was probably just beheaded and given some kind of a merciful death. Other scholars believe he very well might have just died in imprisonment. There's only a tradition that exists. There's not a lot of good secondary literature supporting Paul's kind of what goes on with him. But alongside Paul's time, and this is as we move to the back of the page, the first Jewish revolt, which is very important, occurs in 66. And this leads to major changes in Jerusalem and around the Palestinian or the Judean region. The revolt begins in part due to the confiscation of 17 talents from the temple treasury, and then explodes when sacrifices to Rome are halted. Now, sacrifices to Rome are a very significant thing in this day and age. They are a step beyond paying taxes. They are an allegiance to Caesar that is supposed to be of the same level as your allegiance to God. And you would go and you would offer your sacrifice, and they would have this giant area that you would come into, this kind of the stadium or this large gathering area, and there would be a fiery altar in the middle, and you would go and throw some kind of a sacrifice, like sometimes salt, sometimes maybe olive branches or something like that, and you just toss it in, you just keep going on your way, toss it in, keep going on your way, toss it in, and you would say, Caesar is Lord, Caesar is Lord, Caesar is Lord. Well, what's interesting is the first Christian confession, the first, if you call it that, first Christian creed, is subsequent to that. It's Jesus is Lord. Jesus is Lord. Jesu Christu Kyriou. Jesus Christ is Lord, as opposed to Caesar is Lord. And it's the way that we understand what is going on there. But then the sacrifices to Rome are halted by the Jewish leaders in response. And the Roman governorship under Cecilius Gallus, the legate in Syria, breaks out. And what they basically do is the leader there, Cestius, goes and grabs one of these legions. He grabs the one of the legions right here, and he takes this legion, and he comes across the coast here, and he goes into what is today modern-day Israel to try to suppress the revolt. And there's a map in the atlas about this. You can kind of see with the red line that's going up around the coast, they come in through the coast, and they secure the ports. Now, that's smart. Why do you want to secure the ports? It cuts off commerce, it cuts off trade, it cuts off resupply. Because you don't want to get resupplied out of this area. That's where the caravans are. You don't know what's going to happen. Ports are much easier to control as well. So they come down in this region, and there's a couple skirmishes, a couple battles that happen. But then ultimately what happens is that he is defeated at Beth Horon, and the rebels, the Jewish rebels, are given a surge of confidence. And then what ends up happening is word gets back to Nero that his local governor, his legate in Syria, Cestius, failed. And he was defeated, and his army had to flee. And that battle alone, I mean, there's significant casualties that are happening in this time. And he goes, well, I need to go find the roughest, toughest governor, the roughest, toughest military guy I know. And he goes and he calls on essentially the George Patton of his day. And he goes down and he finds a guy, which I think Patton would have really liked being called the roughest, toughest military guy and equated to Vespasian because, one, Patton believed in reincarnation. But part of that is that Flavius Vespasian was one of the most experienced military generals, having fought in basically Alexandria and Egypt for years and decades. If you can imagine, if you've watched, who's watched, remember Gladiator, the movie Gladiator? Essentially, I'm trying to remember the guy's actual names, Maximus, the one that Russell Crowe plays, it's essentially the same kind of a general, that kind of luminary figure that could command men, that could command armies with just his presence. He knew what he was doing in the battlefield. This is essentially what Vespasian is. He is a seasoned military general. To be fair, Vespasian is one of my favorite characters in history for a lot of reasons. One, because he grew up as basically a farmhand and worked his way all the way to become the emperor of Rome. I mean, it's an amazing story. Vespasian is one of the neatest guys, I think. But then he ultimately, Nero sends Vespasian into the region of Palestine and Judea. Vespasian sends messengers to his son Titus and says, hey, come meet me. We're going to meet in the middle. And they do, and they quash the revolt. And ultimately, the remnants are pursued by Titus across 68 and 69. Vespasian crushes the revolt and then goes back to Rome for a very specific reason, which we're going to get into in a couple minutes. And ultimately, they destroy the temple on August 28th, 70. You'll see the 9th of Ab, which is the way that Josephus describes it, because that's how they were keeping track of calendar at that time. The temple in Jerusalem is torched. Jerusalem is sacked. The temple is destroyed. Sacrifices end. But then the last of the rebels escaped to Masada. We will be at Masada in our trip to Israel. And ultimately, Masada is such an interesting fortification because this is where the Herodium is. And they go up into the Masada, and they go and they escape to there. And they're getting ready. They build a siege ramp. Titus builds a siege ramp. He's getting ready to go in and capture everybody. But instead of being captured, 960 of them, men, women, and children, all commit suicide. And that ends, ultimately, functionally, the revolt. The revolt would end all Jewish sacrifices and signal a shift towards a synagogal system sustained by Pharisees and rabbis. There's a section in the Atlas towards the end that talks about the Bar Kokhba revolt, which is the second Jewish rebellion against Rome. I would encourage you to read that. I'm not going to get into it. Everything changes after Bar Kokhba for the Jews in that region in Palestine in the first century. It's extremely important. But nevertheless, we're going to move on a little bit. One of the most intriguing, this is, by the way, a picture of a statue of Vespasian. This is, again, why I think he's more like George Patton, because he kind of looks like him. But the reality is that in the critical year for the Western world was 69, when four emperors were vying for the throne of Rome, and that three were removed through suicide and execution. And what ends up happening is at the end of 68, Nero, who was probably a little bit nuts, ends up committing suicide. You know, Nero is the guy that they said, the Caesar that they said would play his fiddle while Rome burned. He would put people on fire and line the hallway or line the walkways of his palace with them, so to speak. He was just he was a despot. He was a bad emperor. He ends up committing suicide in 68. The Senate then goes and confirms Galba almost immediately. Galba then takes a whole bunch of his, a whole legion of supporters, including the Praetorian Guard, and goes up into Germania because he believes one of the first things he wants to do is conquer a land to show he is the new emperor of Rome and solidify it. Well, he irritates people and he makes some bad decisions, and the Praetorian Guard kill him on January 15th. And he was actually inaugurated on January the 1st, 69, or he was confirmed by the Senate January 1st, 69, and then he was killed January 15th. Following him, Otho is voted on by the Senate, and then has to commit suicide in Germania to avoid capture after being defeated in April 16th. There are about 40,000 casualties, which is a significant number of casualties for a battle of this time, the Battle of Betorecium. And then Vitellius is killed by Vespasian on December 22nd as there's a confrontation that goes on. Actually, what's interesting is Vitellius had resigned on December 20th and was trying to flee the city, realized Vespasian's coming after him because Vespasian basically said, I want to be emperor. All the legions in the Eastern Empire said, we think you should be emperor too, so we're going to come with you. And he walks into Rome with about four or five legions of Roman soldiers behind him and says, I'm going to be emperor. And the Senate goes, oh, that's a pretty good idea. We think it's a good idea. Vitellius, you should resign. So Vitellius resigns and he goes into hiding. Vespasian finds him, pulls him out, and executes him in the middle of the square. And then Vespasian takes over as the emperor of Rome and rules for 10 years. He also establishes the Flavian dynasty and ultimately takes the throne and leads Rome into a new era. There's a lot of really interesting things around this. If you read Dio Cassius, if you read Josephus, Josephus was the court historian for the Flavian dynasty. Josephus, interesting guy, he was actually a commander of one of the rebel, platoon isn't the right word, but like a rebel segment of the Jewish army who gets captured, and because he can read, write, and knows history, he gets put in by Flavius Vespasian as his authentic historian. And he's supposed to write all the history of the Jewish wars, which he does, a bunch of other stuff too. But then if you read Dio Cassius as well as Josephus and a couple other historians, they talk about Vespasian in some really interesting language. One of Vespasian's claim to fame is that he miraculously healed people in Alexandria. And there's a lot of similarities to the healing stories of Jesus, which causes a lot of historians like myself to ask whether or not those Roman historians who are writing a little bit after Vespasian, right around Vespasian's time and after Vespasian's time, borrowed from the messianic stories and miracles. I've actually written a paper comparing the healing miracles of Jesus Christ and Vespasian, which I had presented at a conference about 10 years ago. No, it's about 6-7 years ago. And it's a really interesting character that goes into all of that. But nevertheless, and here we go. Also, during this time, the segments of early Christianity arose. We see Petrine Christianity, Johannine Christianity, and then we also see some other John's communities that come out of different places. My supposition is that you could have gone into a place like Philippi or Ephesus, and you could have encountered a bunch of different churches that called themselves by different apostles' names. The Apostle Peter, the Apostle Paul, the Apostle John, the Apostle Apollos. They all aligned underneath them, sort of like we have Baptist and Presbyterian and Catholic, though distinctions are a little less subtle in this day and age. It would not have been surprising, as I said, to have multiple communities of differing apostolic allegiances during this time. And then I'll not bore you with this. This is just kind of, this is one of, it's really, it's my area of interest and study is how the early churches formed. Because they didn't form in a vacuum. They didn't, we don't read from the New Testament that they just kind of like, oh, this is what we should do because God told us to. But there's a bunch of different forms in this time that probably led them to come to be in different ways. Jewish synagogues provided some influence from leadership forms. Greco-Roman associations, which were an interesting group of people. Greco-Roman associations would have been a lot like unions that we have today. In this day and age, they would have been burial or funerary cults, that if you were an everyday person, you were getting ready to die, or you knew you were going to die one day because everybody dies, you wanted to be a part of them, they would take care of your funeral and throw a lavish party for you. Somewhat like, and I'm careful in how I use this because it's more of a, depending upon where you're coming from, if you're familiar with Masons, it's a similar kind of a concept there. These had different structures for meetings and leaderships in some of their communities. Also, the Roman system of patronage provided places. If you go to the book of Philemon and you look and you read about Philemon, Philemon was a Roman patron of a house church or a church that met in his house. And was dealing with a runaway slave named Onesimus. If you go into the book of 2 John or 3 John, 2 John is written to the elect lady. It very well could have been a patroness that was having a church that met in her house in that day and age. So the patronage system, because there weren't Christian buildings in this time or distinct Christian buildings, provided a place for them to meet. For another part of this is that what becomes most curious is the lack of a missionary form in other religions. Yet the apostles fulfill this, and other people fulfill this form early on in Acts. We don't know of a good missionary form in other religions. Yet in Christianity, they were compelled by their very nature to go to preach and convert. Well, and baptize, to be honest, and then make disciples. And it seems to be very unique. It's really one of those apostolic innovations that comes out in the first century, which is a really interesting thing to talk about. But ultimately, by the end of the first century, Christianity is widespread and growing throughout the world. And with that, here's a picture of the seven churches of Asia Minor. Maybe in another little bit, we'll go on a trip to the seven churches of Asia Minor. It's kind of a nice little cruise from what I hear, if it's the right time of the year. Some of the places aren't as fancy as they used to be. Earthquakes have a tendency to mess that up, plus 2,000 years of separation. But nevertheless, you can see how they're kind of aligned and arrayed. With all of that said. And then we get this. This is that another chart. This comes from the Atlas. This is kind of the Roman Empire in the early second century. We've kind of already shown this as well. And with that, we ask our final... Any thoughts or questions?